This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
So here we go. And I am back again with another wonderful guest. My name is Conda Mason, and I am hosting this hour. It's called the Brown Rice Hour. And we have conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. And that leaves a wide array of conversation to have with my guests. And today I have Mr. Micah Daigle, who is an amazing being that you all will, you'll see that right away. And I'm looking forward to our conversation today. So Micah, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel really, really honored to be asked to join you and your audience.
Yeah, this is cool. I hope I have an audience. It's just starting, you know, so it could be just you and I and nobody ever hear this. So
awesome.
That too.
Great. Yeah, right, even if right. We have an audience of one.
Right. There you go.
Or an audience of our future selves listening.
That's
to
right. That. Our future selves.
Right.
Well, my sister will definitely listen. So there'll at least be an audience of one.
Great.
Okay. And our future selves. But yeah, so I'm super excited about having you with me. And so, you know, I always like to begin by having a little land acknowledgement and where we are. And I know that you and I both are in the Bay Area. You're in Berkeley, right?
I'm in Berkeley.
And I'm in Oakland, and this is the land of the Ohlone people. Mm-hmm. And so we want to give a shout out and honor the original peoples of this land. And I also like to create sacred space by bringing in the ancestors and honoring them as well. I have deep gratitude for my ancestors who, you know, had a lot of resilience to get me here, you know, alive and halfway with the brain. And I'm really grateful for their resilience and their ability to keep on keeping on. So I just want to give a shout out to the ancestors and your ancestors as well, because we couldn't do this without them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I always like to bring them into the room. And so I'm going to read your bio that I have, and we'll get started. All right.
Sounds great. Yeah.
All right. So Micah is a designer and movement builder. That's the headline. And he's a designer and movement builder working to redesign our world so it works for everyone. I love that already. He started his career advocating against the racist war on drugs as the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. He then shifted from working against the existing system to creating better systems. As a designer, he's worked on tools like, I say Asana or Asana. What do you call it?
Asana, yeah.
Asana, okay. The software program Asana. So as a designer, he's worked on the tools like Asana and Hackpad that help millions of people collaborate. As a campaigner, he helped crowdfund projects like Impact Hub Oakland. And as a strategist, he's helped dozens of founder teams clarifying their purpose, story, and their voice. He's become part of an emerging movement to redesign the foundations of our society, such as the economy or the government. He's currently focused on forming land-based collectives that can experiment with new and ancient ways of living together. So I am so stoked about having this conversation with you. You're hitting so many areas that are close to my heart. And I know that we're going to get somewhere with this. But before we go into all of the amazing places I want to go with you, I ask the same question of everybody, first of all. Okay. And I call this the Brown Rice Hour. One is because when I think about one of the most significant parts of my life is when I became a microbiotic. I became microbiotic, right? Mm-hmm. And I changed my whole diet from meat-based to, you know, to vegetable-based. And and it was an incredible time. This was in the 70s. And brown rice was it. It was all about brown rice. And brown rice had a huge effect on my life. And so I think of it as that it was the comfort food. It was the transitional food. It was, and I still today, you know, have a pot of brown rice on the stove usually. So I'm no longer microbiotic, but I am still vegan. And so anyway, food is important. And I think it has a role to play in our lives and it tells a story. So my question, my first question to you is, what as a child was your comfort food and who prepared it?
Wow, good question. Well, it's so funny. I'm gonna get to your question, but I need to say I didn't realize this until now, but earlier today I really needed comfort food. I was having a hard day. And I'm really bad at asking for help. I'm just like learning to be better at asking for help. And I asked for some help from a dear friend and housemate. And she cooked me a bowl of brown rice with some roasted cauliflower on it. And it was exactly what I needed. And I didn't realize the like amazing synchronicity of that, given that I'm about to be on the Brown Rice Hour. But it seems kind of fitting. Brown rice was not a comfort food when I was a kid. I would say it was like really bad food when I was a kid. It was like a bologna and cheese grilled ant sandwich or something, or like, frozen, Elio's pizza was the brand. It was this, just frozen rectangle of a pizza. Not very good at all. You know, kind of like elementary school pizza. I was in the oven. And I would put it on like broil and I would burn the cheese. Like it would get black.
Yeah. Burn it.
And I loved it. I don't know. Cool. Yeah. I was not a picky eater. And now I totally am. So I.
And you were the one who prepared it then too.
I was the one who prepared it. Yeah.
Who prepared it. Yeah. Wow. That was the thing, huh? It
was like, that was my comfort food.
Like this paper and charcoal, this pizza sounds like it was just kind
of. Exactly. Yeah, it was a lot of frozen food. There were also frozen pierogies, which were the only attachment I had to any kind of ancestry. You know, like I was.
What's a pierogi?
So a pierogi is Polish kind of dumpling, essentially. It's like pasta that has like potato and cheese and that kind of thing in it. And, you know, I'm someone who grew up without really any kind of attachment to any sort of known ancestry. I don't really know anybody beyond my grandparents and kind of where I came from. And the one thing I know is I'm like a quarter Polish. So I would eat these frozen pierogies.
And they were frozen too. You just popped them in the microwave or something.
Exactly, right, yeah.
And so you did it yourself. Nobody else prepared this for you?
Sometimes my mom would, yeah, but I got pretty self-reliant with the frozen food. Now I eat a lot better. Yeah.
I'm really glad to hear that, Micah. Glad to hear that you're doing better than that. But this is great. See, these conversations about food, and they really actually tell a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you were really self-reliant. I mean, I'm now seeing you as a kid that's just like, you know, I know how to do this. I know how to feed myself. I know what I want. And I'm going to just pop it in the whatever you did in the frozen food. That was you as a kid.
That's what I did. Yeah, totally. Now I cook for myself quite a bit as well, but it's not the frozen food I pop in the microwave. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I'm happy that I'm really thrilled that your roommate gave you some brown rice today.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Little brown rice goes a long way. So I just wanted to also let people know how we met.
Yeah.
And we had a very incredible meeting. And I mean, we just took off into this project that was intense. Intense. Yeah. It was intense, right? Yeah. Wouldn't you say? So I was, I'd love to hear your version of it. On my side, I was starting a new company called Impact Hub Oakland, a co-working community in Oakland. And we were just getting started, and we needed to raise some money, and we wanted to do a crowdfunding campaign. And this man named Micah Daigle, who was a friend of one of my business partners, came into our world and said, I can help you with the Kickstarter campaign. And that's how we took off together on that intense Kickstarter campaign. Let me hear your version of it.
Yeah. I'm actually curious. I don't know if you know why I got into crowdfunding.
I don't.
It might be a good place to start.
Yeah, let's start with that.
Yeah. So, I was kind of an activist before I moved to the Bay Area. I was living in Washington, D.C. and running an organization that was working to, stop throwing people in prison for, nonviolent drug crimes. So I was working on that, and then I moved out to the Bay Area and was still working in that movement, but just got really burnt out on working in politics, right? Mm-hmm. As a lot of people do, right?
Yeah.
It's just so hard to meaningfully change things. And oftentimes it's like one step forward, two steps back. I sort of left that movement, and I was trying to figure out what to do with my life. And I had a conversation with a friend where he introduced this concept to me called liquid democracy. Is that something we've talked about?
Mm-hmm. We did a long time ago.
So it was a concept that was new to me, but the idea was we were just talking about everything that's kind of broken with our political system. And he introduced this concept where instead of, like, right now we essentially every 4 years go to the ballot box and we vote on somebody, and somebody wins to basically represent us on every issue, right? And they go to Washington, D.C., and then the people that they're surrounded by are not their constituents. They're, the lobbyists and the other people in their party and all of that.
That's right.
And my friend introduced this idea of, what if we kind of represented each other within a system where if, he was like, Micah, a lot about drug policy and criminal justice and prison reform. What if you represented me on those issues? And I know a lot about, environmentalism and all these other issues. What if I represented you on that? And then we had a system where we could kind of represent each other instead of, somebody who we don't even know representing us. So I got really interested in this idea of what could a new governance system look like? The one that we're using now is centuries old. So that started this kind of career path for me of learning design and technology. And I was, prior to meeting you, trying to start a company to basically create the technology that would allow for us to experiment with this. And so I was trying to start that company, and I realized I don't want to raise venture capital and then, and then 5 years later, we've created the thing and it's successful, but we're spamming people with ads, or we're doing things that are just not in alignment with the vision.
That's right.
I wanted this thing to be a gift to the world and not this, thing.
Or you're booted out and some venture capitalist owns it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was really hesitant to start a company for that reason. And then I realized, crowdfunding was really just becoming a big thing around that time.
It was.
Yeah. And so I just started learning everything that I could about crowdfunding, because it felt like there was a deeper issue here, that if I, mm-hmm. as an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. was facing this problem of, you know, mm-hmm. not being able to bring the things into the world that I want because of the funding mechanisms, then mm-hmm. a lot of other people are as well. And maybe that's a place to focus. So that's when we met, as I was you know, trying to essentially create like a crowdfunding accelerator program,
right.
where
right.
We work with entrepreneurs like you to you know, get your projects off the ground. And of course, I know Impact Hub Oakland needed a lot more funding than we raised through the Kickstarter. So you had a variety of financing mechanisms, right?
Yeah, we did.
That was when you met me. And I was also learning a lot about my own limitations and it was a very intense campaign for sure. We made it. We did it.
We raised more money than for sure any, you know, so-called co-working space had ever done, and more than we imagined. We went way over what we thought we were going to raise, and it was extremely successful, but it was extremely stressful.
Totally.
And I said, I will never do that again. That was the hardest thing I ever did in my life.
I think I learned a lot through that experience too. You know, I think I came into it with a lot of confidence. Like, I know exactly how this is gonna, you know, and I think I've gotten a lot more humble when working with clients now, and also setting expectations a little lower, you know? Learned a lot through that experience.
I think everybody learned a lot in that, you know, but as I said, we did it and it was super successful. God, I remember that day that it closed, the campaign closed.
Yeah.
We were trying to raise $100,000, and we raised like 142 or 143, something like that.
Yeah. And it was,
remember?
It hit 100 maybe the day or two before, and then everything after that was extra. And it was,
Really, even that last day that 10,000 came in as we were just before we closed down the campaign.
Right.
It was like from Mexico. It was great. And it was intense, but that's when what you did, Micah, with me is you're a storyteller, and you got me to tell the real story, like what's underneath. And because we went to that real story, I think that it went to the heart of people, because people love stories and they relate to stories, and you took it out of the realm of, you know, a co-working space, and that's not what it was. It was a way deeper story than that. And you brought that out in us and all of us. And I've just ever been so grateful for that, because I learned that from you. I learned that from you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for that reflection. I feel like story that we developed together for Impact Hub Oakland of what makes you come alive, right? That was the core of the story.
That's right.
It's so alive for me still as a story, right? Like when I think about my mission on this planet, and it's a convergent mission of everybody I want to collaborate with right now has the same mission. It's how can we create the context where people don't feel coerced to work on stuff they don't care about? And how can we create the context where people are completely liberated to do exactly what they would do if they didn't have to worry about how they're going to pay rent or pay for food, you know? And that to me, like I think increasingly I've gotten humble about knowing I don't know all the solutions. Like, you know, we were talking earlier about this liquid democracy thing. I don't know if that's the solution to better governance. Right. And there's lots of people trying different solutions. But what I do know is if we have more people liberated to try new things and to take risks and to give the gifts that are just naturally pouring out of their heart, we're going to figure it out, right? It's right now we're just in such a bad spot because so many people are working jobs they hate that they don't care about, right? And so many of the companies that are destroying the planet rely on the labor of people who wouldn't be working there if they, you know, didn't need to make ends meet, right?
And exactly. They would have nobody there in those big old empty buildings. They'd be empty buildings.
Everyone would walk out. Exactly. Yeah.
Everybody would walk out, you know.
Right.
They couldn't continue to pollute the earth and in toxic, you know, cultures.
Exactly. Right.
People can't walk out.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's a form of coercion there. And so everything I'm, you know, putting my efforts into now is, it's like that. We were talking before about how I was digging deeper and deeper into, oh, well, you know, it's hard to change policies, so let's change the governance system. Oh, hard to do that, so let's change the way that startups are financed. And there seems to be this convergence where a lot of people are digging deeper and deeper into higher and higher leverage points. Like, what's the, you know, the thing that's going to solve all of this? And it keeps coming down to land. It's land and food justice and ownership, really. Yeah. And if we can solve that, if we can really have people collectively stewarding the land that they are on and living in communities where we're taking care of each other's needs instead of outsourcing them to this global market and Amazon and stuff, then I think we can start to really have an impact, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because, as you know, these are conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, spirit, and culture. And it's about land. Mm-hmm. It starts with land. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you know, but here's what the rub is for me and the project that I'm working on, my own little project, is around Black people and the land loss. You know, the land loss is so systematic and so egregiously intentional by the U.S. government and private and banks and all the people who collude, honestly, to take land. I mean, the statistics of, let's talk, and I'm talking rural land, right? Rural land, whereas where most Black people are still in the South, when 50% of Black folks are still in the South.
Right.
And the land that was always that, you know, the 40 acres and a mule that never happened. But people managed to get land after the emancipation, right? And in the 1920s, we had about a collectively, they say 18 to 20, I hear different ones, million acres of land was in the hands of Black folk. Now it's down to 2 million.
Yeah.
And losing 30,000 acres a year.
Wow.
Through the collusion of what the U.S. government, USDA, the banks, and how what they're doing. And the story goes on and on. It's a very intentional, horrible story. And so, you know, I'm finding myself now like, okay, that's the acupuncture point for me, is to step into that place and to see how can I be effective in any way around Black land loss, you know. And because, as you know, with land, that's, I mean, that's how wealth is figured out in this country. And then there's that there's always that tension also around ownership, stewardship. Like,
really?
I don't even want to own it. And yet, if I don't own it, some white people are going to own it. And so I need to own it because they took it. And then really, then the indigenous people were here way before all of us. And who never owned anything and just stewarded it. And how do we get to this place of stewardship versus ownership and at the same time make an impact so that the land is doing what it came here to do, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, this is so much of the research I'm working on right now is what are the mechanisms that allow us to internally within a community steward, but then externally, because the external environment is all about ownership. How do we own it? How do we fence it off and protect it from exploitation, extraction, and right? And so, you know, there's this really great organization, EBPREC, right? East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative.
So cool.
They're doing amazing work in this, where they're literally just taking properties off the speculative market and putting them into the hands of people, right? And so it's so essential to be able to work within the system to whatever degree you need to be able to get this land away from the speculative the speculative market.
Crazy market.
Right.
It's got to get off the market. Land does. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. EB Prec is just amazing. And I'll try to get that website to people afterwards and get people involved and knowing what the work that they're doing in the East Bay is amazing. And, you know, you just said something that that reminds me of this. So, and you said also in your bio, you mentioned that about the fact that, what did you say? You said that that you're not working in the system anymore. You're building new systems, right? Mm-hmm. Which reminds me, of course, of Buckminster Fuller's, you know, quote about you never change things by fighting against the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the old model obsolete.
Right.
And so, at the same time, I want to get your opinion on this, okay? Because as a movement builder, which you say you're a movement builder and a designer. So I learned back in the day when in activism 101 that there were four different R's for transformation, right? The four R's are, there's resist, which is the protests that are out in the streets. You're resisting the current system. The reform from the inside, like the entrepreneur, right? You reform. Right. Recreate is build a new model, build a new world. And then there's reimagine, which is where the mystics hang out and, you know, all those people who can see way beyond where the rest of us are. Uh-huh. And so with that, and when I think about, then I'm thinking about what's happening right now. We are right now at a time when the Black Lives Matter movement is, I never thought I'd see it as broad-based in everybody's mouth as it is right now in America, in white America, and not obviously just Black America. I mean, and not just America, the world. And so I think about that movement, and a part of it is the young people after the absolute tragic murder of George Floyd, resisting in the streets, absolute resisting for weeks and weeks and weeks. So there was this resistance. And then this, I think of it as this reimagine, I mean, like defund the police. It's like, who would ever think that we would get rid of the police? I mean, that's a real reimagination. And it's happening.
Totally, yeah.
And it's happening. So I'm really interested in your thoughts around this combination of resisting, working in the system in any way, recreating, reimagining. Do they work together? I mean, Bucky Fuller says that it's one or the other.
Right.
And it feels to me like it's kind of all of it. So I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Totally, yeah. I'm so glad you brought this up. I feel like this is at the crux of everything right now, right? Yeah, this is it. I have a lot of love for Bucky Fuller. I think he's like one of my, you know, influences and heroes in a lot of ways. But I think he's wrong on this one. I actually do. Like, it's a beautiful quote, but you do change things by fighting the existing reality. You totally do. And that's the history of social movements, right?
That's
You've got to fight.
That's right.
Yeah, like you said it so beautifully with the four R's. I haven't heard that framing before, but you know, I think there are a lot of ways of framing different ways of changing things, and they are all valid, right? Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to focus on is the redesign piece,
and this is
part of the recreate piece, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. a lot of the recreate piece is right now, very open-ended. It's like, let's abolish the police, right?
let's abolish the police.
Right. And so Minneapolis is like, okay, all right.
Okay, let's do it.
Right. And, you know, I'm sitting here being like, well, okay, what does that mean? Like, what comes next? And there are so many potential answers to that. That's a design problem, right? There are just so many ways you could design that system. And I think there is sometimes within activist circles, there can be like a naive assumption that the current system is broken because it was designed to be, it's not broken. It was designed to be oppressive and bad,
totally.
Right? And if you throw that out and just put like the right people in charge of creating the new one, then it's going to be great. And I don't think that's necessarily true, right?
You
can have a lot of good intentioned folks
at the
table
that's
creating
right.
something that then creates the institution that is oppressive and, you know, bad in the long run, not because it was designed that way, but because this is just the history of humanity,
right?
In a lot of ways, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I think with the police example, I think it's a really good question to ask ourselves. Mm-hmm. Do we want people whose role it is to be protectors in our society, right? To be people who use some sort of force to constrain someone who's trying to hurt someone else, right?
Right.
And then in terms of prisons or jails, that's like a more long-term constraining. It's like, okay, this person needs rehabilitation or restorative justice or whatever it is, but they can't be allowed to run amok, right? If mm-hmm. they're, you know, intent on hurting people. And so I think it's a really good question of is that a legitimate role for people to play? And then if so, what happens when you create an institution that mm-hmm. has more power mm-hmm. and more ability to use force against people? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. how do you prevent that from eventually turning bad or eventually attracting the types of people who would abuse that power, right?
Right. That's right.
And so when, you know, I would say it feels like there's an emerging movement, like I said in my bio, mm-hmm. of people who are becoming kind of society redesigners, who are really deeply mm-hmm. thinking about these mm-hmm. issues. Why is it that our government is broken? Why is it that capitalism, you know, starts with one person exchanging goods with another person, doesn't seem like anything is bad with that, and then the emergent system can be so destructive and terrible. And how do we redesign these systems so that we can, one, anticipate some of the like unintended consequences of those things,
right?
But then also anticipate that we're not going to get it right at the start, right? We're always going to have blind spots, mm-hmm. and the system is going to have to evolve. Mm-hmm. So how do we build in, you know, kind of ways that the system can adapt and evolve and change and make it a living system, right?
Right.
So I've been like doing some writing on this recently, and one of the pieces I've been writing about is looking to natural systems mm-hmm. As we design these human systems, and some of the mm-hmm. the really brilliant things that nature and the world, you know, the living world has figured out.
Right.
And one of those things is death. One of those, you know, innovations of life is mm-hmm. that something should not be able to persist forever, because that's how systems evolve and change. And, you know, within the human body, when we have cells that
they come and go.
Yeah, they come and go, exactly. And when they don't,
get a new liver.
Right, exactly. Right. And when there's some sort of mutation that happens that makes mm-hmm. cells want to live forever and start like hoarding resources, we call that cancer in the body, right?
We call that cancer. It's deadly. Right. That's right.
Yeah. And so when you look at a lot of our human systems, mm-hmm. they are not built with death built into their foundation. Right? It's really rare that a law is written with a sunset provision, or that, you know, corporate charters used to be for a set mm-hmm. period of time. It was you get mm-hmm. a 10 or 20 year corporate charter, you mm-hmm. build the bridge or whatever, and then you dissolve the corporation. And now we have these corporations that are outliving the people who are part of them, right?
Yeah.
And they're essentially like a cancer on the planet. So that's something I'm doing a lot of thinking about, is how mm-hmm. do we mm-hmm. in as a kind of meta pattern, when we mm-hmm. start designing these mm-hmm. new systems, if we're going to design a new police force, put an expiration date on it. Say, you know, this design is only going to last for the next 5 years, and then we have mm-hmm. we have to look at it again and redo it again, you know. That's part of what
I'm
thinking.
It's very interesting. So it's like build in the obsolescence, its own demise. And I think that that's really wise, because, as you know, I mean, as a Buddhist, I know, of course, that, you know, the whole law of impermanence, and nothing is here forever, and everything's going to change, and everything is going to come and rise and fall away. But yet we do design these systems as if, you know, they're just these immovable. And that's the other thing, is that because the way we design them, people feel intimidated by it and feel like it can't change.
Right.
We design it in a way that allows people to feel, I think intentionally so, that this is bigger than you. You can't change it. And so therefore you become a part of it. And you whether you want to or not, you're upholding a system that you don't even believe in, because you don't feel like you could change it, for one thing. Right.
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 Yeah, and it used to be that humans, if we didn't like the social circumstances we were in, we would move. And of course, this is also the history of colonialism, right? Because when we moved, sometimes we took the land from other people, right? And,
that's right. That's right. What are you doing on my land?
Right. So obviously we can't and wouldn't even want to do that at this point, right? But now there isn't a square inch of land that isn't owned by some corporation or nation or whatever. We're living in these systems that feel anti-driving, anti-human. And there's no place to go. There's no place to go. It's like I can't just take my tribe and move over there and try something new. And so that's where the land piece comes in, right? How do we start carving out some little bubbles of experimentation and community within the current system, so that we can start trying new things, right?
I love this conversation. It's really at the heart of what I think about a lot, and it's because the systems are. They're built to work. People say this is broken. They're not broken. They're built to do exactly what they're meant to do.
Right.
And to leave a lot of people out and to hurt a lot of people and to harm, to do harm, but to do good for a small number of people. And the truth is that they're not even surviving it. They're not really thriving. It may seem like it because they've got a lot of goodies. You know, they got all the good stuff, the big bank accounts and the big this and the big that. But is that really what being human is all about?
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring this up around, people with wealth or people in positions of power are not thriving, like you said, so in a lot of ways we can look at this like it's an us versus them story. And in a lot of ways, if there is an us and them, it's not really left versus right, right? A lot of the people on the right have just been duped in some way. But it's really about those who hold power versus those
power.
Who don't.
It's all about power.
But even those who hold power are not very happy. They're not thriving. They'd be more happy if they were living in community. I think it's just a really key piece to look at because there are two questions I've like often ask myself that are clarifying questions for like, am I doing the right thing in the world? The first question is, imagine I had a magic bank card. Every time I swiped it, no matter what, like there would just always be money, right? In the card, which is not the case. I grew up in a lower middle class family. I don't have any inheritance, I make okay money now as, a designer, but scarcity has always been a thing that's kind of loomed over me. Mm-hmm. And it's a very clarifying thing to think about what would it feel like to just know that, I'm just never going to have to worry about paying rent or food or whatever. Right. And what would I be doing, with that, right? So that's question number one. Mm-hmm. Question number two is, what if I had $1 billion? Like if somebody just walked up to me and said,
just fell in your lap.
Here you go. Here's $1 billion. Yeah. What would I spend it on? and it used to be a hypothetical question. It's becoming less and less of a hypothetical question, not because I'm a billionaire,
right?
But because I'm surrounded by people who have made vast amounts of wealth in, the tech industry.
Yep.
And they are starting to become aware of,
that's right.
Injustices and their vision and values aligned in a lot of ways. And they're trying to figure out how to best steward that money. And of course, they can donate it to nonprofits, right? They can do the philanthropy thing, but an increasing number of them are thinking about it as like, so the way that I'm framing it is, but one of the best things that you can spend money on is obsoleting money. It's like spend money on creating systems that need less and less money over time. It's the same. It's like the same wisdom around leadership, right? Like the best use of leadership is to make your own self obsolete, right? Empower people around you, create self-governance mechanisms. Because if you get hit by a bus tomorrow, right, like the and the organization falls apart as a result, that's not good. So you want to you know, use that leadership to make yourself obsolete. And I feel like the same is true with money. And if I had $1 billion, what I'd be doing is investing it in communities that can figure out how to take care of the people within that community with less and less reliance on money, right? With regenerative systems that are growing food with the available sun and soil, right? And you don't need to exchange money for that.
That's right.
And I'm not, you know, I'm not like so anti-capitalist that I don't, you know, I could see a role for something like money, you know, in the long-term future, like to, you know, to measure exchange rates or something between communities. But I think largely it, it feels like an aberration because if you just look at living systems, there is no transactions.
No, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like it. I love what you're saying. I mean, you are so at the heart. We gotta hang out.
Yeah.
We really have to hang out.
Let's do it together.
Yeah, let's make that happen, honestly, because, you know, this is the conversation I'm having all the time. And I'm looking at money as this agreement that we've made. We've made this agreement around this thing, and we've given it all this value. It has absolutely no value.
Right.
No value other than what we have assigned it, right? And that we've agreed upon. So let's disagree.
Yeah, yeah.
What if we let go of that agreement? Right. Now what do we have, right? And so where does the value lie? Where would we put our value if we took it, if we digressed and took our value from money and put it somewhere else into living systems or whatever, what you're talking about? That's the conversation that I want to have. And I too, you know, I don't want to also, like, you know, the 99% and the 1%, you know. Yes, of course, it does exist. And those who have a lot of wealth are not bad people. There's a lot of really good people. Some of them, yes, absolutely. But there's a lot of really good people that I have in my life as well that I'm around that I have learned, like, wow, you are amazing. And what you're doing is really incredible. And I'm finding as well, and maybe it's the Bay Area thing, but I hope it's beyond the Bay Area. And it seems like it is because I mean people, you know, nationally who are wealth holders who are really looking at how to do this way differently.
Yeah.
And then the other thing of mine is that their next generation, like, you know, this is the biggest generation that's going to inherit more wealth than any generation in history. Right. And a lot of them, they don't want it. And so I've been dealing with parents whose kids say, I don't want it. I didn't earn it. I don't want it. And the parents are going, oh my God, right? Like, wait a minute. This came all the way down from, and where did it come from? Where did it come from? I'll tell you where it came from. We call it racial capitalism because where did it come from?
Totally.
It came from the millions and millions and millions of free labor of African people in this country for over 200 years. It came from the theft and the genocide of the indigenous people.
Yeah.
All of it points back. Every single bit of it points back to that. And so when we look at this situation and, you know, we only... and particularly, and that's the one thing I want to talk to you about, Michael, because people like yourself who are on the cutting edge of these kinds of thought leadership and are, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, 36, yeah, young and millennial type and really smart and white and male, you're thinking about all these things. And I don't know if you go all the way back and reel it back to to the beginning.
Yeah.
Because that is what we have to do. The things that I'm doing is taking people on a plantation in Louisiana. I'm taking wealthy people and other non-wealthy people, really cross-class, cross-race, coming together on a plantation in Louisiana, talking about land, race, money, and spirit and the roots of capitalism. And really looking at the truth of it. And that is what is necessary. We have to take it back because sometimes there's a tendency, I got to say, I love you people, but I also find that there's times when you all stop before you get to genocide and slavery.
Yeah,
Totally. You can't do that. You got to stop doing that. Tell me you're going to, if you've been doing that, tell me you're going to stop. Or if anybody around you've been doing that, tell me that you'll check them, because they got to go back to that, where it really all came from. It came from the millions and millions of hours of free labor.
Yeah. And there's, there's no making that right. I mean, there's things we can do to repair. That is a crime that is, it's unconscionable. It's absolutely unconscionable. That's and, right. So, you know, a bit about my story and upbringing and all of that. I was raised by conservatives. You know, my parents are Trump voters.
Where were you?
In Rhode Island. Which, you know, a lot of people think, oh, it's a blue state, right? There's progressives there. Literally, on my rural dirt road that I lived on, there were Confederate flags. There was a lot of racism. And I was brought up, you know, within a context of, I think it's in some ways it's a gift that I can understand where the other side comes from. I'm obviously not a conservative. But you know, my parents, you know, I was the first person in my entire extended family to go to college. It was kind of a fluke. I got accepted to college, but, extended family is pretty not well off. You know, they come from, you know, I hear about stories of like my mom and aunts and all of them in like this crowded house shitting in a bucket, you know, this kind of thing. Right. And the story of, you know, poor white people working, you know, clawing their way up, and how hard it is for them to be reached by language about privilege and reparations and all of that, because they're like, I didn't do that. Right. You know,
I was poor. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I, you know, that was my mindset growing up as well. You know, I listened to all the conservative radio show hosts. I was like, why can't people pull themselves up by their bootstraps?
Why can't they just do that?
Right. And then you learn, you have to really be humble enough to listen and not defensive. And so something I try to work on is, there's this great post going around talking about how white people need to be the welcome party to the movement, right? That if me as a white person is like shouting at someone and being like, you know, fuck you for not acknowledging your privilege and all of that, it's just going to push them away and, you know, push them into the hands of white supremacists and all,
right?
And it's completely understandable that people of color would be angry and would, you know, shout at somebody who's being ignorant and racist. And that's why it's like a good use of my privilege to be more patient and to be more understanding with someone like that. And I think I've had some really great conversations with friends and acquaintances who just didn't really get it until somebody took the time, in the same way that I didn't get it until somebody took the time with me. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to do that work myself. Yeah. I know a lot of other people are, but it's so important that, you know, as we move toward just, you know, bring it back around to the land projects.
Right.
So many of, you know, the land projects within my community are, you know, they're led by white, privileged, rich people who can buy the land And there's really great innovation work going on in these, you know, like eco-villages in Costa Rica. You know, they're figuring out new ways of, you know, living together and all of that. But it's also an experiment. And, I mean, it's an exercise in privilege, and it's very, very white. And for me, it's very important to me that if I'm going to, you know, start a land project and start working on, you know, ideally creating, you know, the seeds of an anti-racist society, it's got to start anti-racist from the start. And you've got to
from the start.
You can't just have a bunch of white people who are also like, oh, well, you know, diversity is important to us, so let's bring in people of color, to the thing that we are
building. Let's call Conda and see if she'll come and hang out.
right. I'm sure you get some of that.
Oh, baby, I get it all the time. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. No, it's gotta be founded and led by.
That's right. That's right.
By people of color, because I mean, it's just if you're really committed to building, you know, reimagining new systems.
Right. Yeah.
You've got to have people in the room who have been, you know, who have bared the brunt of the systems that came before, or else you're going to have blind spots all over the place.
That's right. And you're going to rebuild the same thing, honestly. And, you know, I don't know if you know about, I'm going to point towards my dear friend, Namaka Agbo, who restorative economics and just transition. And what she's just killing it right now. She's here in Oakland, and she's stewarding some really interesting assets and resources as well. And what she's doing and how she's doing it is amazing. Mm-hmm. And but it, you know, at the basically it involves that those who are most impacted must be at the center.
Right.
Simple.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Totally. Yeah. And so I'm at a place of trying to figure out how do I serve? Like, how do I serve? Yeah. You know, I've got a whole lot of privilege as a white man. And now I happen to have some skills that are really valuable within, within Silicon Valley. Yeah. And I have, friends who have lots of money and all of these things. And how do I hold all that privilege in a way that actually serves rather than, perpetuates the same systems. And it's why I want to get more involved with EB Prec. I want more recommendations of other organizations I can get involved in.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's like when you asked me to be on the podcast, there was a bit of hesitancy because I don't have a thing to pitch right now. I really don't. I don't have a project. I don't have, I'm just doing a lot of listening right now. And just really trying to recognize what my skills and resources and all of these things are, and then listen to what really needs to be done. And then also building the bridges. Between all the communities that need to be involved in this, right? And I'm sure some project will emerge that I'll be able to say, I'm doing this, right? But it's like being part of a movement is sometimes about not exactly knowing what your role is in the movement yet.
And that's right. That's okay. Right. And leading from and stewarding from behind as well, and being able to know when to lead, know when to follow, all of that is important. But your thought leadership is, and your heart is so needed.
Oh.
And yeah, for real. And that's why, I'm not looking for someone who has projects. That's not me. You know me better than that.
Yeah.
I'm just needing to talk to the real deal people who are thinking through and looking at, a better world, and that knowing that we can create it. If we've created this, we can uncreate it.
Yeah.
We could create something else.
Yeah.
And so, and it's necessary. It's so necessary, right? And if people don't at this, I don't know when this is going to broadcast, but in this moment, we're at a moment that people are waking up who have been not so woke and realizing, we really need transformation.
Mm-hmm.
We really need change. And it takes a lot of being proactive and really stepping into discomfort and being okay with that and listening. Like you said, listening is a big one. And, ever since George Floyd was murdered, I a lot of people knocking on my door. Kinda, what do you think? Kinda, can you? And I just stopped. I went into silence, honestly. I did a week-long retreat right here in my house and did a meditation retreat for 7 days with without talking to anybody and listening. And that's where I still am right now. I'm just coming out of that a little bit. But by and large, I want to hear what people are saying and what's going on. And I'm forming my own thoughts and I'm pushing edges. And so that's why when your email came across my inbox, I was like, Micah.
Oh, oh, Conda.
Right? It was like, it's just time for us to dig in. And,
yeah.
And the fact that I have this podcast, I was like, okay, let's just do it. Let's do it live.
Yeah, right. I love it. Yeah. I feel like we're all just figuring it out. And, you know, we haven't talked about COVID at all yet, right?
Which, no, we haven't.
You know, when our 10-year from now selves listen to this podcast, it's going to be a really key part of this moment, right?
What's
going on?
Oh yeah,
with the pandemic, and I, you know, it's such a. I'm curious what you're thinking about this, and I have some questions for you. I'll say it's such a mixed bag for me, in that obviously it's, you know, just so devastating to see all of the pain and death that's happening, particularly to communities of color and people who are our quote frontline workers, aka minimum wage.
That's right.
So it's so heartbreaking and so frustrating and fucking infuriating.
Yeah.
To look at how different countries have handled this, and just to see how completely lacking of care we are as a country, and what our government has done, right? And so it's so frustrating, it's so scary and heartbreaking. And then in some ways it's catalyzing, right? In some ways, this moment is getting people to take a step back and look at what's really important, and recognize that, I thought I had security because I had money in the bank, but like if the supply chains break down and I can't get food from the grocery store, maybe that's not, you know, real security. Right. And people spending more time with their kids and working from home and realizing they could have been working from home from the start. Yeah. And, you know,
that's right.
There's a lot of things that are being catalyzed right now. And I'm thinking a lot about how we can leverage this, into whatever comes next. Right. And so I'm curious how you're thinking about it.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts, and it's interesting because I just gave a talk this morning, an online conversation. It was church, actually, for Spirit Rock, and on Sunday morning. This is a new thing that they have, and I talked about it. And honestly, what I see is, like, you know, every system, a system can only go so far without getting feedback.
Right.
And so I see that we have been in this non-feedback space for way too long, and you know what happens when a system doesn't get feedback. And so I see the coronavirus as feedback. It's the feedback that we finally has come knocking on the door.
Right.
It's like, shine the mirror.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is who you are, humanity. Mm-hmm. This is what you've been up to, and this is what is happening. And so all the weakest, most marginalized are finally seeing that this is the system that you've created.
Totally.
This is the system you've created. And so I see this huge feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And in that feedback, I think, so when you don't get feedback within the system, what the future is not connected to the past, because there's no seeing it yourself, right? You're just willy-nilly going out there. But when you get feedback, I think that's when there's the possibility arises that you can actually create a better future, and present and future with feedback. So the upside and the silver lining is that glimpse of a better future. That is where the silver lining is, right? And yet the darkness is who we are and what we've created and the feedback we're getting.
Really? Yeah.
And so they're both existing at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I imagine you're a fan of Octavia Butler.
I love Octavia Butler.
So good. So good.
I love Octavia Butler.
Yeah.
No, she's just beyond. And I mean, it's so interesting. I'm got to tell you Octavia Butler's story is that the last thing I did, before I sequestered was my friend Toshi Regan, who I don't know if you know who Toshi Regan is. She's a musician out of D.C. Her mother is Bernice Regan, who started Sweet Honey in the Rock, the group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Okay. Anyway, Toshi's a badass. She took Parable of the Sower and turn it into an opera.
What?
And yes, and she's been doing it all over the East Coast and different places. It came to LA, right? At Royce Hall at UCLA. And it was right on the verge. It was like March 3rd or something like that. And I saw the tsunami coming of COVID. And I was like, I had tickets. My partner and I had tickets. It's like, are we going to go? Are we going to go? And I was like, I don't want to miss it. Went down. It was the very last thing I did.
Oh, wow.
To see Parable of the Sower.
What?
Okay. As an opera.
Wow.
And then come back and sequester into this calamity.
Yeah. Wow.
The lived experience. It was crazy.
Uh-huh.
So that's the last thing I did before I sequestered.
Yeah.
I love her work.
I brought her up because, last year I reread the Parable series, and, for better or worse, I've always been kind of an apocalyptic thinker. My name, Micah, is it's a book in the Bible that is both short and apocalyptic. And I am both short and apocalyptic, so it's I stay true to my namesake. And
you really are both,
right? And for a long time, I've just been talking with friends about how are we going to communicate if our if phone lines go down, if the internet goes down. I have these mesh networking devices I've pollinated throughout my community so that we can communicate when the grid collapses and all these things, right? And some of that is informed by reading Octavia Butler, because she could see the impending collapse of the systems. And what she also saw is that when the systems collapse, those that are already marginalized are the first to, they're on the front lines of the wave of destruction that washes over. And so this is why I've never really been able to get down with tear down the system, right? I totally respect, like we were talking about before with the four R's, everybody's got a role. But I have friends who are just all about let's tear it all down, And if you don't have the thing that comes next, what happens when it gets torn down? Exactly. And I think COVID is like a little, little example of this, where even the economic collapse we're seeing right now and the pandemic itself is not hurting rich people, right? It's hurting. Right. And so we've really got to think, I think, larger than tearing down the system. We've got to think about what really comes next. What is the new thing?
Well, when I think about one of the things that I feel is the unifier that I feel like I'm seeing on the planet right now. And because, first of all, so we got to talk about the sequence of COVID and then George Floyd's murder.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't think George Floyd's murder would have had the impact on the planet it had if it had not been for COVID.
Totally.
Okay. Because another black man killed by a white cop, right? And I don't mean that cavalierly, but that is the truth.
Right.
But because of COVID, we were all a little bit more sensitive, a little bit more quiet, a little bit more like watching each other. The world was connected. We were aware of life and the sanctity of life. We were honoring those people who were saving lives. We were clapping and celebrating people saving lives.
Right.
And then this cop came and took this black man's life.
Right.
Like just murdered him in the streets.
Yeah.
And everybody was quiet and still enough and had enough sensitivity to say, what?
Mm-hmm.
right? The two came together as this perfect storm.
Yeah.
And what I feel that I'm seeing is planetary grief.
Mm-hmm.
People are grieving.
Mm-hmm.
They're grieving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's through that grief where our liberation is somehow tied.
Yeah.
It's through that grief. Because it brings us back to this sense of interconnectedness that is just human. This grief is so deep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my hope, you know, because as you on the apocalyptic side, I am like on the, you know, why can't we all just get along side?
Totally.
And right. And it is my hope, honestly, that this grief that we are all sharing for different ways and different reasons, that it will unite us to go through it and come out on the other side with something different.
Yeah.
That's my hope.
It's the only way through. It's really the only way through. You've got to let it go.
Yeah.
And that's what grief is. It's the painful letting go.
It's the painful letting go.
Right.
It's painful. It's
and,
very
and
painful.
Really facing the pain that you were too busy or too strong to feel at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel that's what COVID has done as well, is that
it has.
We're all so busy all the time, right? We're running around. It's like,
I slow the whole world down.
Right. And we can actually feel how wrong that all of it is. Right?
All of it. All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. And then, like you said, people are home with their children instead of out doing. And it's like, oh, this is what I should be doing. This is real life.
Right.
You know, those videos are showing people all the cities throughout Europe and all the cities that are empty.
Right.
I mean, wow.
Yeah. And remembering what we really miss as well, right? Like, I don't miss Target. Right? What I miss is a hug from a close friend.
I miss
friend,
a hug.
Right?
I do miss hugs.
Yeah.
I do miss hugs.
It's clarifying.
Yeah.
It's like,
It's like, what's important, y'all?
Uh-huh.
What's important? What does it all boil down to, really?
Right.
What is this life all about? And so it's like this, like our sensories have been dulled and now it's like, oh, with my eyes closed, if I walked around with my eyes closed all the time, you know, would this fancy iPhone 11 be important to me?
Right.
You know, I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah. It's only important to me to the degree that it allows me to talk with you. I mean,
That's right. That's me. Exactly. It's utilitarian.
Yeah.
And the fact that this happened at a time when we have like Zoom and all this technology that, I mean, had this COVID happened, you know, I don't know, 20 years ago,
right.
It's like, what would we?
Yeah, totally. How would we even deal with it? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And everybody's, you know, hating on Zoom. Oh, I don't want to Zoom. I'm like, I'm so grateful for Zoom. Mm-hmm. It has really brought, and I've had great parties and gatherings and all kinds of fun. You know, I'm grateful for it. And this time that I have with you, I mean, right? We wouldn't have been able to see each other. And this has just been lovely.
Oh, likewise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
I know. And it's coming
to heart.
A close. it's coming to a close. And I just want to say, Micah, how beautiful this has been for me. And I'm so grateful to have you in my life. And let's keep it going. Let's keep it going. Let's keep talking and you know, bring me into your thoughts and your world, and I'll bring you into mine. And
and I want to know more about what you're working on. We still need to talk about Jubilee.
Gotta talk about me.
We gotta talk about that.
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that. Okay, we'll definitely do that. So we'll do another Zoom call.
Sounds good. Yeah.
All right. Is there any last thing you want to say that's on your mind?
Hmm.
I also noticed you said that the collective agency is coming back.
Maybe under a different name.
I love that name.
It is a good name. Others have picked it up and run with it since I put it on hold. And so I may need to rebrand it. I guess I can just briefly talk about that. So the collective agency, the vision was sort of decentralized creative agency of independent creative people who are helping other people to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the same way that we did with Impact Hub Oakland.
Right.
There's an increasing number of people, you know, my friends who are going independent. They're, you know, they don't want to be part of a large organization anymore. They want to do the kind of work that I've been doing with clients, but it can be lonely. And so if we can support each other and create a network of people who are, mutually supporting each other, but not, you know, not being coerced into work.
Right.
That's the key piece for me. Right. Is that if you join a creative agency, the creative director tells you what to work on. And because they have all this overhead, and I got to pay all the salaries and all that, it means you're working for these big corporations. And then now you're employed, you're essentially just an arm of Google or something.
Yeah.
And so, if you have any audience members out there who are creative people, you know, designers, filmmakers, writers, strategists, and are either thinking about going independent, or are independent and are kind of lonely and struggling and that kind of thing. I'd love to be in touch. I think we can support each other. And then ultimately the end goal is we liberate all of our agency, right? Like everybody has more agency to do the things that we would naturally just the gifts that naturally want to come through us as creative people. So
that's fantastic. So can we give people your email at the end of this?
We sure can. Yeah.
We can. Okay.
Should I give it now?
You can do it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hi at Micah Daigle, micahdaigle.com. And we'll have a new collective agency site up soon or whatever we decide to call it.
Great. So. All right. Well, I'm excited. And I loved the collective agency. As a matter of fact, quickly, your website, that website that you had, has had the most influence on me of what I want as a website. You were the first person that I saw, you know, the bold letters. You had really big, and I fell in love with that. And I have always wanted that. And I am doing a website, and Jubilee Justice is going to have that kind of look because that's what I've always wanted.
Cool. Well, yeah, definitely let me know if you know creatives who want to work with us, and also if you know people who are looking for creative work. Yeah, I got some really great people I'm working with who are amazing designers, better designers than me. I've shifted more into like story and strategy and stuff. So
Well, you're good at all of it, and I'm really excited about it. So I will definitely, so people will hear that, and on my own, I will. I'm thinking about throwing some people your way.
Sounds good.
All right.
Cool.
But we're going to like just come to a ending with this incredible conversation. Micah, thank you for joining, and just keep on keeping on, man. I love what you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you for what you're doing. Can't wait for more.
All right. We'll see each other soon.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.